Simon & Schuster Audio presents Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Colbert.
That life on Earth changes with the climate has been assumed to be the case for a long time. Indeed, for very nearly as long as the climate has been known to be capable of changing. Louis Agassiz published Études sur les Glaciers, the work in which he laid out his theory of the ice ages, in 1840. By 1859, Charles Darwin had incorporated Agassiz's theory into his own theory of evolution. Toward the end of On the Origin of Species, in a chapter titled Geographical Distribution, Darwin describes the vast migrations that he supposes the advance and retreat of the glaciers must have necessitated. As the cold came on, and as each more southern zone became fitted for Arctic beings and ill-fitted for their former more temperate inhabitants, the latter would be supplanted and Arctic productions would take their places. The inhabitants of the more temperate regions would at the same time travel southward. As the warmth returned, the Arctic forms would retreat northward, closely followed up in their retreat by the productions of the more temperate regions. And as the snow melted from the bases of the mountains, the Arctic forms would seize on the cleared and thawed ground, always ascending higher and higher as the warmth increased, while their brethren were pursuing their northern journey. For Darwin and his contemporaries, such a narrative was necessarily speculative. Much as the existence of ice ages had had to be inferred from the signs they left behind, erratics, moraines, and striated bedrock, so, too, the succession and redistribution of species on Earth could only be reconstructed from fragmentary traces, scattered bones, fossilized insect casings, ancient pollen deposits. Even as paleontologists and paleobotanists found more and more evidence of how species had responded to climate change in the past, it was taken for granted that the process was not something that could be observed in real time, an assumption that has now been proven false. Almost anywhere you go in the world today, except perhaps for the urban areas where most of us live, it is possible to observe biological changes comparable to the northern expansion of the comma. A recent study of common frogs living near Ithaca, New York, for example, found that 4 out of 6 species were calling, which is to say mating, at least 10 days earlier than they used to. While at the Arnold Arboretum in Boston, the date of first bloom for spring flowering shrubs has advanced, on average, by 8 days. In Costa Rica, birds like the keel-billed toucan, once confined to the lowlands, have started to nest on mountain slopes. In the Alps, plants like the purple mountain saxifrage and Austrian drab have been creeping up toward the summits. And in the Sierra Nevada of California, the Edith's checkerspot butterfly can now be found at elevations 300 feet higher than where its range used to end. Any one of these changes could, potentially, be a response to purely local conditions, shifts, say, in regional weather patterns or in patterns of land use. The only explanation that anyone has proposed that makes sense of them all, though, is global warming. The Bradshaw-Holtz-Apfel Lab occupies a corner on the 3rd floor of Pacific Hall, a peculiarly unlovely building on the campus of the University of Oregon in Eugene. At one end of the lab is a large room stacked with glassware, and at the other, a pair of offices. In between are several workrooms that look, from the outside, like walk-in refrigerators. Taped to the door of one of them is a handwritten sign. Warning, if you enter this room, mosquitoes will suck your blood out through your eyes. William Bradshaw and Christina Holtz-Apfel, who run the lab and share one of the offices, are evolutionary biologists. They were introduced as graduate students at the University of Michigan and have been married to each other for 35 years. Bradshaw is a tall man with thinning gray hair and a gravelly voice. His desk is covered in a mess of papers, books, and journals, and when visitors come to the lab, he likes to show them his collection of curiosities, which includes a desiccated octopus. Holtz-Apfel is short, with blonde hair and bright blue eyes. Her desk is perfectly neat. Bradshaw and Holtz-Apfel have shared an interest in mosquitoes for as long as they have been interested in each other. In the early years of their lab, which they set up in 1971, they raised several species, some of which, in order to reproduce, required what is delicately referred to as a blood meal. This, in turn, demanded a live animal able to provide such a meal. For a time, this requirement was met by rats sedated with phenobarbital But as rules about experimenting with animals grew more stringent, Bradshaw and Holzapfel found themselves forced to decide whether it was more humane to keep sedating the same rat over and over again, or to use a new rat and let the old one wake up to find itself covered with bites. Eventually, they grew weary of such questions and decided to stick to a single species, Wiemia smithii, which needs no blood in order to reproduce. At any given moment, the Bradshaw Holzapfel lab houses upwards of 100,000 Wiemia smithii in various stages of development. Wiemia smithii is a small, rather ineffectual bug. Wimpy is how Bradshaw characterizes it. Its eggs are practically indistinguishable from specks of dust. Its larvae appear as minuscule white worms. As an adult, it is about a quarter of an inch long and in flight looks like a tiny black blur. It is only when you examine a Wiemia smithii very closely under magnifying glass that you can see that its abdomen is actually silver and that its two hind legs are bent gracefully above its head like a trapeze artist's. Wiemia smithii completes virtually its entire life cycle, from egg to larva to pupa to adult, inside a single plant, Sarracenia purpurea, or as it is more commonly known, the purple pitcher plant. The purple pitcher plant, which grows in swamps and peat bogs from Florida to northern Canada, has frilly, cornucopia-shaped leaves that sprout directly out of the ground and then fill with water. In the spring, female Wiemia smithii lay their eggs one at a time, carefully depositing each in a different pitcher plant. When flies and ants and occasionally small frogs drown in the leaves of the pitcher plant, Sarracenia purpurea is carnivorous. Their remains also provide nutrients for developing mosquito larvae. Sarracenia purpurea does not digest its own food. It leaves this task to bacteria, which don't attack the mosquitoes. When the young mature into adults, they repeat the whole process, and if conditions are favorable, the cycle can be completed 4 or 5 times in a single summer. Come fall, the adult mosquitoes die off, but the larvae live on through the winter in a state known as diapause, the insect version of hibernation. The exact timing of diapause is critical to the survival of the Wiemia smithii, and also to Bradshaw and Holzapfel's research. In contrast to most insects, which rely on a variety of signals, including temperature and food availability, to regulate the onset of dormancy, Wiemia smithii depends exclusively on light cues. When the larvae perceive that day length has dropped below a certain threshold, they stop growing and molting. When they perceive that it has lengthened sufficiently, they take up again where they left off. This light threshold, which is known as the critical photoperiod, varies from bog to bog. At the southern end of the mosquito's range, near the Gulf of Mexico, conditions remain favorable for breeding well into the fall. A typical Wiemia smithii from Florida or Alabama will, consequently, not go dormant until day length has shrunk to about 12.5 hours, which at that latitude corresponds to early November. At the far northern edge of the range, meanwhile, winter arrives much earlier, and an average mosquito from Manitoba will go into dormancy in late July, as soon as day length drops below 16.5 hours. Interpreting light cues is a genetically controlled and highly heritable trait. Wiemia smithii are programmed to respond to day length the same way their parents did, even if they find themselves living under very different conditions. One of the walk-in freezer-like rooms in the Bradshaw Holzapfel lab contains locker-sized storage units, each equipped with a timer and a fluorescent bulb, where mosquito larvae can be raised under any imaginable schedule of lightness and dark. In the mid-1970s, Bradshaw and Holzapfel demonstrated that Wiemia smithii living at different elevations also obey different light cues. High-altitude mosquitoes behave as if they were born farther north, a discovery that today might seem relatively unremarkable, but at the time was sufficiently noteworthy to make the cover of Nature magazine. About 5 years ago, Bradshaw and Holzapfel began to wonder about how Wiemia smithii might be affected by global warming. They knew that the species had expanded northward after the end of the last glaciation, and at some point in the intervening millennia, the critical photoperiods of northern and southern populations had diverged. If climatic conditions were changing once again, then perhaps this would show up in the timing of diapause. The first thing the couple did was go back to look at their old data to see if it contained any information that they hadn't previously noticed. There it was, Holzapfel told me, just hitting you right in the eye. When an animal changes its routine by, say, laying its eggs earlier or going into hibernation later, there are a number of possible explanations. One is that the change reflects an innate flexibility. As conditions vary, the animal is able to adjust its behavior in response. Biologists call such flexibility phenotypic plasticity, and it is key to the survival of most species. Another possibility is that the shift represents something deeper and more permanent, an actual rearrangement of the organism's genetic code. In the years since they established their lab, Bradshaw and Holzapfel have collected mosquito larvae from all over the eastern United States and much of Canada. The couple used to do the collecting themselves, driving across the country in a van equipped with a makeshift bed for their daughter and a miniature lab for sorting, labeling, and storing the thousands of specimens they would gather. Nowadays, they more often send out their graduate students who, instead of driving, are likely to fly. Getting through airport security with a backpack full of mosquito larvae is a process that, the students have learned, can take half a day. Each time they collect a new batch of insects, Bradshaw and Holzapfel put the larvae in petri dishes and place the dishes in locker-size light boxes, which are jokingly referred to in the lab as mosquito Hiltons. They then test the larvae for their critical photoperiod and record the results. When Bradshaw and Holzapfel went back to their files, they looked for populations that they had tested at least twice. One of these was from a wetland called Horse Cove in Macon County, North Carolina. In 1972, when the couple had collected mosquitoes for the first time from Horse Cove, their files showed, the larvae's critical photoperiod was 14 hours and 21 minutes. They collected a second batch of mosquitoes from the same spot in 1996. By that point, the insect's critical photoperiod had dropped to 13 hours and 53 minutes. All told, Bradshaw and Holzapfel found that in their files they had comparative data on 10 different subpopulations, two in Florida, three in North Carolina, two in New Jersey, and one each in Alabama, Maine, and Ontario. In every single case, the critical photoperiod had declined over time. Also, their data showed that the farther north you went, the stronger the effect. A regression analysis revealed that the critical photoperiod of mosquitoes living at 50 degrees north latitude had declined by more than 35 minutes, corresponding to a delay in diapause of nearly 9 days. In a different mosquito, this shift could be an instance of the kind of plasticity that allows organisms to cope with varying conditions. But in Waiamaya smithii, there is no flexibility when it comes to timing the onset of diapause. Warm or cold, all the insect can do is read light. Bradshaw and Holzapfel knew, therefore, that the change they were seeing must be genetic. As the climate had warmed, those mosquitoes that had remained active until later in the fall had enjoyed a selective advantage, presumably because they had been able to store a few more days' worth of resources for the winter, and they had passed this advantage on to their offspring, and so on. In December 2001, Bradshaw and Holzapfel published their findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. By doing so, they became the first researchers to demonstrate that global warming had begun to drive evolution. The Monteverde Cloud Forest sits astride the Cordillera de Tileran, or the Tileran Mountains, in north-central Costa Rica. The rugged terrain, in combination with the trade winds that blow off the Caribbean Sea, make the region unusually diverse. In an area of less than 250 square miles, there are 7 life zones, each with its own distinctive type of vegetation. The cloud forest is surrounded on all sides by land, yet, ecologically speaking, it is an island, and, as is often the case with islands, it displays a high degree of endemism, or biological specificity. Fully 10% of Monteverdean flora, for example, are believed to be unique to the area. The most famous of Monteverde's endemic species is, or at least was, a small toad. Known colloquially as the golden toad, it was officially discovered by a biologist from the University of Southern California named Jay Savage. Savage had heard tell of the toad from a group of Quakers who had settled at the edge of the forest, Still, when he came across it for the first time on May 14, 1964, at the top of a high mountain ridge, his reaction, he would later recall, was one of disbelief. Most toads are dull brown, grayish-green, or olive. This one was a flaming shade of tangerine. Savage named the new species Bufo peregrinus, from the Greek word glenos, meaning bright or gaudy thing, and titled his paper on the discovery, An Extraordinary New Toad, Bufo, from Costa Rica. Since the golden toad spent its life underground, emerging only in order to copulate, most of what was subsequently learned about it had to do with sex. The toad was, it was determined, an explosive breeder. Instead of staking out and defending territory, males simply rushed the first available female and fought for the chance to mount her. Amplexus is the term of art for an amphibian embrace. Males outnumbered females, in some years by as much as 10-1, a situation that often led bachelors to attack amplectant pairs and form what Savage once described as writhing masses of toad balls. The eggs of the golden toad, black and tan spheres, were deposited in small pools, puddles really, often no more than 1 inch deep. Tadpoles emerged in a matter of days, but required another 4 or 5 weeks for metamorphosis. During this period, they were highly dependent on the weather. Too much rain, and they would be washed down the steep hillsides. Too little, and their puddles would dry up. Golden toads were never found more than a few miles from the site where Savage originally spotted them, always at the top of a mountain ridge, and always at an altitude of between 4,900 and 5,300 feet. In the spring of 1987, an American biologist who had come to the cloud forest specifically to study the toads counted 1,500 of them in temporary breeding pools. That spring was unusually warm and dry, and most of the pools evaporated before the tadpoles in them had had time to mature. The following year, only one male was seen at what previously had been the major breeding site. 7 males and 2 females were seen at a second site a few miles away. The year after that, a search of all spots where the toad had earlier been sighted yielded a solitary male. No golden toad has been seen since, and it is widely assumed that after living its colorful, if secretive, existence for hundreds of thousands of years, Bufo peregrinus is now extinct. In April 1999, J. Allen Pounds, who heads the Golden Toad Laboratory for Conservation in the Monteverde Preserve, published a paper in Nature magazine on the golden toad's demise. In it, he linked the toad's extinction, as well as the decline of several other amphibian species, to a shift in precipitation patterns in the cloud forest. In recent years, there has been a significant increase in the number of days with no measurable precipitation, a change that, in turn, is consonant with an increase in the elevation of the cloud cover. In a separate article in the same issue of Nature, a group of scientists from Stanford University reported on their efforts to model the future of cloud forests. They predicted that as global CO2 levels continued to rise, the height of the cloud cover in the Monteverde Preserve and other tropical cloud forests would continue to climb. This, they speculated, would force a growing number of high-altitude species out of existence. Climate change, even violent climate change, is itself, of course, part of the natural order. For the Earth's flora and fauna, the last 2 million years have been particularly turbulent. In addition to the glacial cycles, there have been dozens, perhaps hundreds, of more abrupt climate shifts, like the Younger Dryas. At such moments, species have had 3 options, and really only 3 options. They could move to more hospitable locales, they could evolve so as to adapt to new conditions, or they could simply die out. 30,000 years ago, the North American landscape was dominated by outsized megafauna, including 750-pound saber-toothed cats, elephantine sloths, and 15-foot-tall mastodons. Nearly all of the megafauna went extinct around the same time, at the end of the last ice age, when forests began to invade what had been grasslands, and, perhaps not coincidentally, when humans arrived on the scene. Human-induced climate change applies similar pressures, but to a world already under strain. For the last 2 million years, even as the temperature of the Earth swung wildly, it has always remained within fixed parameters. The planet has frequently been colder than it is today, but rarely warmer, and then only slightly. When the climate shifted from glacial to interglacial conditions, it is now known, many species survived by moving toward the poles or up to higher elevations, just as Darwin hypothesized, and when the glaciers returned, they moved back toward the equator or to lower ground. If the Earth continues to warm at the current rate, then by the end of this century, temperatures will push beyond the envelope of natural climate variability. At that point, species that have already retreated to the poles or, like the golden toad, to the tops of mountains, will have nowhere left to go. Meanwhile, species have to contend with a great many obstacles that didn't exist in the past. Farms and cities and subdivisions and logging operations and parking lots and superhighways all have diminished the amount of available habitat and, perhaps just as significantly, broken it up. G. Russell Coop is a professor of geography at the University of London and one of the world's leading authorities on ancient beetles. He has shown that under the pressure of climate change, insects have migrated tremendous distances. For example, Tachinus chylotus, a small, dullish brown beetle commonplace in England during the cold periods of the Pleistocene, today can only be found some 3,000 miles away in the mountains west of Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. But Coop questions whether such long-distance migrations are practical in a landscape fragmented by humans. Many organisms, he has written, now live in the functional equivalent of oceanic islands or remote mountaintops. Certainly, our knowledge of their past response may be of little value in predicting any future reactions to climate change, since we have imposed totally new restrictions on their mobility. We have inconveniently moved the goalposts and set up a ballgame with totally new rules. A few years ago, 19 biologists from around the world set out to give, in their words, a first-pass estimate of the extinction risk posed by global warming. They assembled data on 1,100 species of plants and animals from sample regions covering roughly a fifth of the Earth's surface. Then they correlated the species' current ranges with climate variables such as temperature and rainfall, and calculated how much of the species' climate envelope would be left under different warming scenarios. Using a mid-range projection of temperature rise, the group concluded that if the species in the sample regions could be assumed to be highly mobile, then fully 15% of them would be committed to extinction by the middle of this century. And if they proved to be basically stationary, an extraordinary 37% of them would be. The mountain ringlet is a dun-colored butterfly with orange and black spots that curl along the edges of its rounded wings. Mountain ringlets feed on a coarse, tufted grass known as mat grass, overwinter as larvae, and as adults have an extremely brief lifespan, perhaps as short as 1 or 2 days. A montane, or mountain species, it is found only at elevations above 1,000 feet in the Scottish Highlands, and farther south in Britain's Lake District, only above 1,500 feet. Together with a colleague from the University of York, Chris Thomas has for the last few years been monitoring the mountain ringlet, along with 3 other species of butterfly, the Scotch Argus, the Large Heath, and the Northern Brown Argus, whose ranges are similarly confined to a few locations in northern England and Scotland. In the summer of 2004, researchers for the project visited nearly 600 sites where these specialist species had been spotted in the past. Documenting a species' contraction is more difficult than documenting its expansion. Is it really gone, or did someone just miss it? But preliminary evidence suggests that the butterflies are already disappearing from lower elevation, and therefore warmer, sites. When I went to visit Thomas, he was getting ready to take his family to Scotland on vacation and was planning to recheck some of the sites. It's a bit of a busman's holiday, he confessed. As we were wandering around his yard in search of commas, I asked Thomas how he felt about the changes he was seeing. He told me that he found the opportunities for study presented by climate change to be exciting. Thomas was the lead author of the extinction study. Ecology for a very long time has been trying to explain why species have the distribution that they do, why a species can survive here and not over there, why some species have small distributions and others have broad ones, he said. And the problem that we have always had is that distributions have been rather static. We couldn't actually see the process of range boundaries changing taking place, or see what was driving those changes. Once everything starts moving, we can begin to understand. Is it a climatic determinant, or is it mainly other things like interactions with other species? And of course, if you think of the history of the last million years, we now have the opportunity to try and understand how things might have responded in the past. It's extremely interesting, the prospect of everything changing its distribution and new mixtures of species from around the world starting to form and produce new biological communities. Extremely interesting from a purely academic point of view. On the other hand, given our conclusions about possible extinctions, it is, to me, personally, a serious concern, he went on. If we are in the situation where a quarter of the terrestrial species might be at risk of extinction from climate change, people often use the phrase of being like canaries, if we've changed our biological system to such an extent, then we do have to get worried about whether the services that are provided by natural ecosystems are going to continue. Ultimately, all of the crops we grow are biological species. All the diseases we have are biological species. All the disease vectors are biological species. If there is this overwhelming evidence that species are changing their distributions, we're going to have to expect exactly the same for crops and pests and diseases. Part of it simply is we've got one planet, and we are heading it in a direction that, quite fundamentally, we don't know what the consequences are going to be.